I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
People can change anything they want to. And that means everything in the world. Show me any country and there'll be people in it. It's time to take the humanity back into the center of the ring and follow that for a time. You know, think on that. Without people, you're nothing. Without people, you're nothing.
Stoke the fire.
All right, everybody, welcome to another edition of Stoke the Fire. As always, we are your humble hosts, Matt Stocks and Jesse Leach. Talking about lighting, ladies and gentlemen, to start the show this week. And I've got to tell you, Jesse, I look awful. Like, I've just got the worst. I don't look awful, but can you even see me? I feel like I'm in like a German expressionist horror film or something.
No, it's great. It's great. I love it. It's very noir lighting, especially in black and white. It's going to look great.
Yeah. Apologies if you are watching and you can't make out what's going on. But I'm moving house, dude, in a few weeks. I'm finally moving out of my dad's. I'm going to finally get my own place. It's only taken me a year and a half. And when I'm in the new place, I think I'm going to invest in one of those circular little desk lights that the influencers on YouTube use to beam some nice radiant, you know, rays onto my face, so the people at home need to see this face.
Yes. That's what I use when I'm home. It's great. I recommend it.
Oh, so you've got one. So yeah, they do come recommend
my studio. Yeah. And they got different colors you can put on them. They're great.
So today's a day off for you. And then tomorrow, correct me if I'm wrong, is your last show of this amazing 6-month run with Slipknot.
Yeah. Last show of the year as well. Yeah. A Knotfest in LA.
Wow.
I can't wait to do it. It's going to be a huge crowd. And I also just can't wait to see my lady and go on a road trip. And just, we completed 6 weeks during this time of touring.
Zero casualties as well, right? No COVID cases in any of the camps with all four bands?
There was a few in the Slipknot crew, but that got sorted out very quickly. And yeah, no real casualties. The show went on.
Amazing, man. And how's it been? Like, you know, we could probably do a whole episode on it, so we'll have to like condense it down because we've got an amazing guest to invite on the show momentarily. But if you could sum it up in a brief paragraph, the last 6 weeks.
Strange
in the picture.
Strange if you're used to touring a certain way, but my gratitude for getting back to it and my love for the craft and my amazing crew and band, it's been great, honestly. I don't wish to do a lot of touring this way. I really don't, because I miss getting out and being able to socialize with people and fans. But overall, just very grateful I was able to do it. So, yeah.
Amazing. And you get to see your lady in 24 hours or less.
Yes.
I bet you're happy about that.
Yeah, I don't want to bore everyone with how I feel about it. But yeah, I'm elated.
You do that on Instagram anyway, mate. They know you're a love bug.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, cheers, dude. It's really good to see you. And as
good
you can hopefully tell, spirits are high and not the liquid kind. I am 11 days off the booze as of today.
And, congratulations.
A couple of weeks ago, we had my friend Jake on the show as a guest. He told his amazing story. And then he kind of just mic dropped me at the end and was like, you're going to quit drinking today, here, now. And I couldn't really kind of refuse that instigation down. You know, I'd already planned to stop at a certain date, but he was like, no, that's bullshit. You're just going to stop now. And because of everything he just told us, there was no way that I was even going to like contend, you know, the gauntlet that he threw down. And it was just that final push that I needed. So far, so great. Life's awesome again. I'm at peace. I'm happy. I'm inspired. I'm positive. Life's good.
Yes. I love it. Congratulations, my man.
And today's guest is amazing. He is a legend. He signed Metallica when he was 24 years of age. He also signed White Zombie. He's worked with Nina Simone, Cyndi Lauper, The Misfits. A previous guest on this show, Mina Caputo, he worked on her debut solo album, which is incredible. He's a New York legend. You're going to be meeting him for the first time in this show, right? I know you've got loads of mutual friends. Obviously, there's kind of lots of crossover and stuff, but this will be the first time you guys have properly conversed, right? Which is exciting.
Yeah, I've known of him since I was a teenager. He's a legend and a New York City icon, and friend to many friends of mine. So I'm excited to hang out with him for a little while.
Well, let's get him on. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please say hello to the one and only Michael Alago.
Come on down, brother.
Like magic, there he is.
There he is.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We got you loud and clear, Michael.
Okay. Just so you know, we all look jaundiced.
Yeah. It's odd lighting all around.
Especially me.
Wait, I see a little thing over here that says this meeting is being recorded. Do I just get rid of it? Get rid of it?
No, you're good. Our end, we can't see it, so it shouldn't come up in the show, as long as it's not going to throw you too much. Just to let you know, Michael, as well, this is being recorded. This is a podcast. Is that all right?
Of course. Now, does one ever say the F word here?
Oh, you
one
say whatever
can
you
say
want.
Whatever one desires, Michael.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I'm sure you will. First of all,
Matt, it's so nice to see you. And Jesse, I have wanted to meet you for such a long time. You know, there are artists out there that are good, and then there are great artists, and you happen to be one of them.
Wow.
And today I actually purchased Songs of Loss. What is it called? Songs of Loss and Separation.
Yes.
And wow. When that record starts, man, you feel like you are being taken on a journey already.
Wow. Thank you.
So, you know, it's a beautiful recording. I just ordered it on Amazon today, but every time I pulled up like a video, I saw that most of the time the lyrics were there as well. And I love to carry, what is it, to carry the weight?
Mm.
I love that. And when you just close the whole thing with Forever, it's just so beautiful. It's like the record is like one with the universe. You know, I love when a recording has a beginning, a middle, and an end to it. And that's what this record is. It does. It has, it's complete. And I love that. So thank you. Because these days also, there are very few records I want to hear throughout. And there are very few artists that I could say, wow, I love hearing that voice.
Wow, that's very high praise.
I just love hearing your voice. And I'm glad, this was out of the blue, because when Matt says, do you want to do the show again with Jesse Leach? And I was like, oh my God, yes, I do. So here we are.
I'm honored by your words. Thank you so much. High praise.
Yeah, this guy knows a thing or two about music, ladies
and
gentlemen.
Yeah, a little bit.
Listen, all I could tell you is that I have been a very hard worker my whole life. Like I knew growing up in Brooklyn at 14 years old, and L'Amour nightclub was six blocks away from where I lived. And I started going there when I was 15 years old. I always knew I wanted to be in the music business, but I didn't know what that meant, because I didn't play an instrument and I had no idea what it meant. So I just was, you know, going to concerts my whole life, and until I turned 19 years old. And, you know, I've told people this story already, so I'll make it brief. I was 1 year at the School of Visual Arts in New York City, and I was taking lunch one day, and I walked down East 11th Street. And I went to saw this beautiful building called Casa Galicia. It was a Spanish dance hall. Everybody knows it either as the Ritz or Webster Hall. In 1980, it was the advent of MTV, and it was called the Ritz. And I went in there, and it's an Art Deco building, and it is really beautiful. And there was a man in the balcony, and I always say him, it's like the Wizard of Oz. He was like, kid, what do you want? I was like, I want a job here. And he said, do you have a resume? I said, a resume? I have no idea what a resume is. I'm a kid from Brooklyn, and I go to School of Visual Arts. Well, he laughed at that. And he said, come up to my office. So I went up to his office, and we started talking about music. And we talked about everything from the Great American Songbook from back in the day to what was going on Top 40 radio, what was going on in the music scene in New York. And he said, you know what? I like you. I'm going to give you a job. You're going to open my mail. You're going to get my lunch, and you're going to answer my phone. Little did I know that this guy, Jerry Brand, was an entrepreneur. He started a nightclub called the Electric Circus in the 1960s. He discovered Carly Simon, the voices of East Harlem. He worked in the mail room with David Geffen at William Morris Agency until they both elevated out of the mailroom. And Jerry helped bring the Rolling Stones to the United States. He worked with Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke. If I knew all that information when he was talking to me, I probably would have had a friggin' heart attack and died. But that was the beginning of everything having to do with being in the music business. And I guess I went on for way too long, but that was the beginning of me really being a hard worker.
You're a hustler, Michael, a straight up hustler.
I beg your pardon. you giving me some money, honey?
It's an inspirational, every single like chapter and evolution of your journey is so inspiring. And the fact that you can walk into a room and just kind of, you know, seize that opportunity at such a young age is amazing. And as you say, that's just the start. When you first go to gigs and shows, because I imagine we're the same in the sense you've obviously done much more than me, but I, like you, I think started going to shows and realized very quickly, I want to be a part of this, but I don't play anything. So what can I do? And I had to find my role. Mine became this, you know, doing interviews and talking to artists. Did you know as soon as you started going to CB's and Max's and, you know, and Lamore's and all these local New York venues, as punk is exploding and it's all happening, did you know right away, I want to be a part of this, so I've got to find a way?
Well, like I said earlier, I always wanted to be part of the music business, but being a young person, I didn't know what that meant. But I loved all sorts of music. My first concert when I was 13 years old was the last night of the Billion Dollar Babies tour at Madison Square Garden, Alice Cooper. And wow, that changed my life forever. So I would buy the Village Voice, which then maybe was a dollar back in the day. And I would go either to the porn sites or to the rock and roll sites. Both of them were the same thing in my book. So I just started seeing all this stuff coming up. So after Alice Cooper, I saw, oh my God, Lou Reed is coming to play at the Felt Forum. I would see Lou Reed. And oh my God, Todd Rundgren is playing Central Park. And then I went to that. And then all of a sudden, I was looking at all the advertisements at CBGB. And I went, oh, this sounds interesting. The Dead Boys and the Damned. I'm going. So I had my listening was, how do you say, was varied. I listened to everything. I love all types of music. You know, I still can't get my ears around opera, but that's okay. But yeah, so at a young age, I just started going to everything. And we can fast forward. And at one point, after 3 years of working at the Ritz, helping Jerry Brandt be the assistant booking agent, I knew that there was more out there. And I was seeing this guy, Mitchell Krasnow, and he said to me, you know, my dad's going to re-up Elektra because it was in the crapper. And he goes, I want you to meet my father. His father, Bob Krasnow, had major, major history. And the same thing happened with me. I went to meet Bob Krasnow. We started talking about music, all types of music. And he said, I like you. And I'll give you a bell in about 2 weeks. I'm going to be setting up my A&R department. So I got a call from him in 2 weeks. And he said, I'm hiring you. And I practically cried. And he said, speak to Ruth in human resources and let's get the show on the road. So I had to call some friends of mine in the music business. And I said, what does A&R mean? Well, they laughed in my face, of course. And for the audience that doesn't know what that means, it's artist in repertoire. And artist in repertoire is the most important part of a record company. And it's because if you don't find great, not good, great artists and make great records, you're screwed. And Bob Krasnow, the chairman, would always say, you're going to sink or swim. And I intended to swim. And I did that for 25 years. It was extraordinary. I mean, so much happened in that 25 years, of course, or not of course. But, you know, I was saying, I don't know if this was on camera, how much I had wanted to meet Jesse. And, you know, in talking about, like, I would listen to cassettes every day for almost 25 years. And I heard lots of good stuff. But you can't have good in your life. I needed great, whether that great was being asked by Cyndi Lauper to executive produce a record for her? Of course I'm going to say yes. Whether that's hearing James Hetfield from Metallica for the first time, whether that's going to some little dingy box and seeing White Zombie, who didn't have one friggin' song. But I knew that there was something there. There was a germ of something. And when I talked to Rob, I fell in love with Rob. And he said to me, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to make movies. And I friggin' believed that. And look what happened. I mean, there's a great story in my book. It's called I Am Michael Alago, Breathing Music, Signing Metallica, Beating Death. And I did all of those things. And now I have no idea where I'm going with this story.
It was going to be a little section from the book, maybe in relation to Rob.
Okay, sure, why not?
Or maybe not.
I haven't shut up yet. But
no, it's good. You're making our job easy, man. That's great.
Okay, fine. So yes. So at one point, it's so funny because when people ask me about my life, I say I can tell it to you in 90 seconds. I was at the Ritz. I was at Elektra. I was at Geffen. I was at Elektra. I was at Geffen. Somewhere in the middle, I was at Palm Pictures, and that's 25 years right there. But we can fast forward because there is a great story about White Zombie in my book. And
is it the part with the sample, the voiceover?
It's a sample, and it has to do with Russ Meyer.
Yes, this is a great story.
Director of Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Yeah.
So I see them in this little bar under a restaurant in the East Village on Lafayette Street. And I go all the way to the back, and the stage is about this high off the ground. And my friend Daniel Ray, who was in Masters of Reality, he wrote Pet Sematary for the Ramones. And Daniel is one of my dearest friends of 40 years. He said, you know, he was showing off a lot of bands in New York that he was working with. He was working with Raging Slab and Circus of Power and White Zombie. Those two other artists got signed to RCA, and nobody could give a damn about White Zombie. They had already recorded for Caroline, and those records were really noisy. My favorite kind of music. So I go there, I listen. They didn't have one song. And like Rob says in my documentary, we didn't have one song. He must have been really drunk. I was, but that doesn't matter. Because when I started talking to them, I got a vibe from these people that these young people on the stage, we were all young people then, were wildly charismatic. And you know, you can't buy charisma. You can't buy that thing, that it factor. You either have it or you don't, you know? So that's why when I talk about greatness, whether we're talking about Jesse and both of his bands or we're talking about James, you can't buy that. Ooh, I'm either going to cry or I got goosebumps. Ooh. Anyway.
That's how you know you're a real one right there. That's real talk. That's real. I love it.
So, you know, I met up with White Zombie. They would come to my house and we would watch blaxploitation films, and we would watch, I don't know if there was anything like whitesploitation, but it was either The Carpenters or Blackula. And we would sit on the floor of my living room and we would make these white Russians with Kahlua and heavy on the vodka, and we became fast friends. I knew I was going to sign them to Geffen. I did sign them to Geffen. They started working on songs because they really needed to work on songs. So my friend Daniel Wright produced them, and we hired Andy Wallace because we loved the sound of his Slayer records. So that was a winning combination. We put the record out. What's it called? La Sexosista.
Is that your dog, Michael? Have you got a dog?
No, that's New York City outside. And that's an ambulance, and that's also New York City outside. Darling, it's about atmosphere. Anyway.
You are correct.
Right. Thank you. Don't interrupt. So, wait. Okay, now you made me forget. Okay, so we...
La Sexosista.
We make the record, and we put it out on Geffen, and I'm telling everybody at the marketing meeting, this is going to sell a million units out of the box, bop, bop, bop. Oh, boy. So at about 180,000 units, it just stalls. And so now at the next marketing meeting, everybody is looking at me like, what are we doing, Alago? We gave them a year's tour support. We tried to get them on the radio as best we could. And little did I know that these two little characters called Beavis and Butthead fell in love with them.
Yep.
And they start playing the single.
Thunder Kiss, yeah?
Thunder Kiss 65.
They were like the tastemakers of the MTV era, weren't they?
As crazy as that sounds, those two little challenged characters, they decided that White Zombie were their favorite band. They would play that song at all hours of the night or early in the morning if you're up all night. And that catapulted it to a million units. Never mind MTV was already about 10 years old and everybody wanted to be on MTV back then. So while we were making the record, I'm just backtracking a little, but I think the audience will follow me, is Rob wanted to use a sample that said, "Get Up and Kill." And I said, "Well, where is that from?" He said, "From Faster Pussycat Kill Kill." And I said, "Oh my God, Russ Meyer. I love Russ Meyer. Kit Natividad, one of my favorites." So I am never at loss for words. I have no shame or I'm never afraid to call someone up. I called Russ Meyer and I said, "Oh, is this Mr. Meyer?" And he said, "Yes, who is this?" I said, "My name is Michael Alago and I work for Geffen Records." And he said, "Stop right there." I panicked. He said, "You mean David Geffen?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you think he wants to give me $450,000 to finish up the valley of the Ultra Vixens? And I said, "I don't know, but that's not why I'm calling you." And he said, "Why are you calling me? I'm sitting here with a double hernia and I'm not in the mood." I was mortified. I said, "Well, I signed a little band called White Zombie and we want to use a sample called Get Up and Kill from Faster Pussycat. How much are you paying me?" I said, "How's $1,000? He said, "Can you get it to me tomorrow?" Now, when you work for corporations and you've got to go to business affairs, you got to wait for that check. So I said, "Let me fax, talk about old school. Let me fax you a one sheet, sign it, and I'll get you the money." And I wound up getting him the money because I went to business affairs. I said, "Gary, please, you really just need to give me the money." So he gave me the money. We got the sample cleared. And the nice part about all of that is, you know, like I said, the record came out, it stalled, it sold a million, it sold a couple million. And what happened there is Russ Meyer took a liking to me. We had a little bit of a letter writing correspondence, and I was just totally flipped out by that, because one of my heroes. And at one point he sent me every VHS, not that I have a VHS player anymore, but I am going to get one again. I'm sure you could find one on eBay of every one of his movies.
And that's a lot of films. That's a lot of films.
A lot of boobs, hon. Yeah. Fabulous.
Oh, man. I mean, the size of the kind of letters that you must have hopefully kept and archived over the years, from Nina Simone to Patti Smith, were guys like Keith Haring and Basquiat, were they close friends of yours, or were they more like people you would run into around the city?
Well, Keith Haring is someone who I ran into around the city all the time. And Basquiat, Jean-Michel Basquiat, we were friendly. We both went to a high school called City as School. It was an experimental high school. And you would have classes all around the city. And I don't know, we just kind of became friends. We would cut the classes, and there was this brownstone in Brooklyn, 100 Livingston Street. And we would sit there and chat. And I said to him, "I'm going to be in the music business." And he said, "I'm going to be famous." And we both got to do what we wanted to do. And he had these little composition books and he would just doodle in them. And if anybody knows, or the audience knows, what that work looks like, it's a combination of like a child's scrawl mixed with Egyptian hieroglyphics and mixed with letting you know that he was black. And that's what the work looked like. It was childish and potent. And I remember seeing an early drawing of a piece called Famous Negro Athletes that was in this little composition book. It later became a painting that sold for millions of dollars. He was one of those famous artists that also died at 27, you know, yes. The 27 Club. But yeah, you know, we got to see each other a few times, always on the streets in New York. Later on, Andy Warhol became like his biggest like patron. He was just extraordinary. He is one of my favorite painters. So if y'all don't know what the work looks like, Jean-Michel Basquiat, he's world class, world famous, and gone too soon.
Yeah. So. Like a lot of those guys, there's that Keith Haring documentary, which aired on the BBC over here recently. It was incredible, incredibly moving story.
He was very young. I think he might have been only 38 years old when he succumbed to AIDS. And that was very early on in New York City, when all we had in the gay community was fear. That's it. We had fear.
So. Could we talk about that time from that perspective, if you're all right with that, Michael?
Cause, sure.
You know, we've obviously just come out of this global pandemic, but I guess...
we haven't even begun with... What's it called again? COVID. to see how much I want to forget it.
Yeah, same.
Listen, two things, and we'll do about whatever you want to talk about, Matt and Jesse. But I don't even know what happened in 2020. Like, where were we? Well, I was isolated in my apartment. I was ready to kick the fucking TV in because I watched too much MSNBC, which you can't do. You know. I was looking out my terrace down 8th Avenue in Chelsea and down to the West Village, and I saw everything getting boarded up. Like, what was happening? It was scary, very scary. And then here we are in 2021, went by like that. In 2 months, it's going to be 2022. And boy, this whole year, did I have arguments with friends, unfortunately. You know, there are so many people out there who, and this is not a, not pointing a finger, but, you know, I have friends out there who won't get vaccinated, and I have a compromised immune system. So unfortunately I can't be around them. You know, I can't be around people like that. And you have your own life. I have my own life. And, it's a very tricky world in regard to this, virus right now. And it also has nothing to do with who's getting vaccinated, who's not getting vaccinated. It's tricky because we watch television and the NIH, the CDC, every day they say something different about how you can acquire this.
Mm. Yeah, that I can speak to that, because being out here on the road and touring, it's just, how do you get it? How do you not? We're like in a quarantine situation out here and people still got it. You got people who think they know 100% what's going on. And to those people, I say bullshit. Like you said, it changes constantly. Nobody's got a solid grasp on the situation. And that's what makes it so difficult to deal with. And it does cause division. And I think the main thing for me as a musician being out here touring under these circumstances is, number one, just get through it. And number two, and I do this every night on stage, try to bring people together. Try to bring like a sense of unity. And when I speak on that, I think a lot of people do want to get past this. I think a lot of people do want to unite. But we are living through such divisive and, strange times. It's super frustrating.
Mm-hmm. You know, recently these aftershock shows happened. And there was Metallica, Misfits, Metallica. And I didn't go because, Metallica management will tell you, they live in a bubble backstage. Nobody goes backstage. That's it. Cut and dry. And, you know, I don't like hearing that, but I understand that whole thing. But I also didn't want to go masked and sit in an audience all day because I have a compromised immune system. So I just decided, you know, I haven't even gone to any big shows yet. One or two of the big shows I wanted to go to, and they'll remain nameless, people in the road crew or some of the opening act artists, they got COVID. And then, you know, half the show gets canceled. And I thought to myself, I don't know. I'm going to stay home and friggin' watch Netflix and make X-rated collages at night. And that's my friggin' life, right? And I've shot a lot of black and white portraits outdoors. And yeah, I want to do your portrait, Jesse. I did a beautiful one of Billy from Biohazard, Alpha Ministry. I constantly shoot my man, Doyle. But the point of this is, I don't even know what the point of this is.
There is no point, Michael. We're just riffing. Right.
We're riffing, but that it is, it's tricky. Politics are tricky, on personal levels, on professional levels. It's a crazy world that we're living in, and nothing is yes and nothing is no. And like I said, we hear different information every day. So I like to just say to, friends, family, just take care of yourself. Be respectful, when I go out still, if I walk down side streets in New York City, I take my mask off, because if it was literally just airborne, we'd all be dead already. But when I see crowds of people on the street, I go to the pharmacy, I go to the grocery store, I put it back on. I don't have a problem with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's about, the bottom line for me is about being considerate to people.
Absolutely.
Whether or not you believe everything that's being said, whether or not you buy into the narrative completely, just be considerate. And I don't understand on either side of this issue why that's so difficult. And it just, again, shows to me how important it is to spread love and positivity and try to be a light in a dark world. And it's given me a whole other sense of purpose being out here and seeing that. Just don't be a dick to people. I mean, how hard is that?
Whether there's a virus or not, Just be human, be respectful, be kind. I always tell people kindness is like a domino effect. You be kind and you hope that everybody else is going to spread that. And that's just what I do. And like people always say to me, well, you never post up politics on social media, honey. There's people who speak about politics much better than I could ever. So all I post online is about music and art and theater and meditation and prayer, whatever prayer means to you. And I always keep a positive outlook, because I just, for myself, I can't have it any other way. Don't want it.
I love that.
I want to rest my head on my pillow at night with just a little bit of peace of mind.
Love that. Amen, brother. Yeah, I guess I want to circle back, because I am actually curious too. We're talking about New York City during the AIDS crisis. And sure. I guess now that we've talked about COVID times, do you see any similarities? What was it like and what were the differences? Sure. What a crazy time to live through.
Oh, yes. I definitely see a correlation with both pandemics. People have a big time fear. Back then, though, at one point, I drank and drugged a lot. I loved my vodka. I loved my Jaeger. Blacked out a lot. And I, with my bad behavior, I acquired HIV. Fast forward just a little bit, I then acquired full-blown AIDS. I had no immune system. It was effed up. And it was right before any medication came out. So all my brothers at the record companies who got full-blown AIDS, most of them wound up dying. I had a doctor who was in the laboratories all the time, and she took a big liking to me. Big old lesbian, fabulous. She would ride her bike to my house every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. While I'm lying on the sofa, I think I went down to like 70 or 80 pounds. She was like, how are you today? And I'm like, I don't know, Barbara. I don't know. She said, you got to hang on. So it was like, if anybody saw Dallas Buyers Club, it was like Dallas Buyers Club. Fast forward just a little. She said one morning, she said, you really should go to St. Vincent's Hospital. And I'm like, I'm not going to any AIDS ward. That will most certainly kill me. I have great insurance because I work for Time Warner. Use and abuse that insurance. But I'm not moving. I want you to treat me from my sofa. So at one point I got vitamin drips, IV. I got something called pentamidine so my lungs wouldn't fill up with fluid. And I was on that sofa for a year and a half. She said, Michael, as your primary care, there's something called AZT. I don't want you to take it. I said, Barbara, you're keeping me alive. I ain't taking it. Everybody, male, female, who took AZT died from that. So she said, you got to hang on. I hung on.
That's beautiful. You're a strong man.
That was 30 years ago. So, you know, I hung on. And then I do about a year and a half or so later, I get back to Elektra. And, you know, it's the 90s and everybody's talking. And it's like, can we hug Michael? Can we shake his hand? Of course you can. It's like back in the early 70s when people say, can I sit on that toilet bowl seat? Can I catch something from the toilet seat? You know, no, you couldn't catch anything from me. It was a sexually transmitted disease. And so I got back to work and I started taking one of the first, what they call antivirals back then. I think it was called Cequinivir. And I got better. And I never had full blown again. I have a compromised immune system. Thank God for all the state-of-the-art medications. I was 32 going through that. And wow. I still drank. Barbara wanted to. I sometimes do a little crack too. And Barbara, I told Barbara, said, Michael, you are killing yourself. And I knew that. But, you know, when you're an alcoholic, you can't tell anybody anything until they really do reach rock bottom. So I reached rock bottom. And that was 30 years ago. When I 30 years ago when I was 32, I'm 62 now. I have no viral load in my body whatsoever. I take one state-of-the-art pill every day. I don't argue with myself. I get to Alcoholics Anonymous every morning on Zoom, 7 days a week. That 1 hour sets my head right. I also don't argue with myself. There's lots of literature out there to read for people who are struggling. And, you know, I go 7 days a week because the way people help me, I'm here to help others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes some of the biggest problems that we have is asking for help.
Yep.
Ask for help. A lot of our musician friends, we all know them, actors we know and love, have killed themselves because they didn't ask for help. Hmm. And, you know, the brain is a very tricky thing. Speaking of tricky things, I'm not a doctor, but I know that the brain, we all know that the brain is tricky. And when people want to commit suicide, they don't give a shit. They just do it. Because there is no light, that the brain does something. I have a friend in London, her older brother was an alcoholic, 3 teenage sons and a wife. He said, oh, I stopped drinking. One Saturday, the mom is making breakfast for everybody. Where's your father? Oh, I don't know. Isn't he in the bedroom? No, go find your father. He's probably in the garage. He was in the garage. He hung himself that morning. Can you imagine pulling down your dad, the wife, and 3 sons? But that's where alcoholism and drug addiction, when you have a problem, and that's no exaggeration at all, that's where it takes you. It takes you to death. So anyway, oh God, I don't want to bring everybody down here, except that's life, you know? Yeah. And when people talk to me, you know, I'm not a legend. I'm not a hero. I am a very hardworking human being. And I would have been a cliche of sex, drugs, and rock and roll if I died, but I didn't die. So I'm not a cliche. I lived from all of that. And in 2021, I'm living. I live a good life. And so many good things have happened to me because I'm clean and sober. Last week, maybe 10 days ago, I was clean 14 years. And the week before that, I turned 62. So, you know, it's all good. I can't complain. I mean, I could complain about my friends, my family, but we're not going to do that.
That's beautiful. Congratulations, man. That's, I mean, that, that type of stuff is an inspiration. And I think it's important for people like you to help other people, because you can't truly understand a situation until you've lived through it and you've gone through it.
Sure.
And that's the most powerful testimony you can hear all day from people about, you know, the dangers of addiction. But if you haven't lived through it and come out the other side of it, there's no real power behind those words. So I commend you for that. That's awesome.
Thank you. You know, it's funny. I think it's funny now because I lived through it. But I remember one morning I woke up. I came to, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
I was in New York in my apartment. The next thing you know, I'm in a crack den in New Orleans. I do not know how I got there to this day. I don't know why the airlines let me on the airplane. I was in the worst, like, section of New Orleans. I was in this row house until I had no money and they kicked me out. I was walking down the street. I saw this guy and girl. I said, you want to go to the motel? They said, sure. They robbed me of everything except my friggin' boxer shorts and my sneakers. I don't know why I had money in my sneaker. And I'm furious now. I'm so high. And I'm like, rah, 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 walking down the street. And a cop car comes over. Sir, do you have ID? I said, excuse me. Do I look like I have IT? I just got robbed. He said, step away from the car. And I was like, oh, God. He said, so where do you live? I said, I live in New York City. And they laughed in my face. They said, you from New York? And you let this shit happen to you? I was furious. But I don't know. I didn't want to, like, start a thing with the cops. So he said, well, get in the car. And I said, are you taking me home to New York? And he said, sir, are you still staying somewhere? I said, oh, I'm staying at dot, dot, dot street. And he said, well, that's where we're taking you. So it's the middle of the night. The light is coming up. I get to my friends and I fall right out of the back of the cop car, and there was still a party going on, and Shauna and Phil and Selmo and Sean from White Zombie are like, wait a minute, is that Largo who fell out that cop car? And I was like, hi, honey. I walked in, I fell on the floor. I have no idea. Now we can all laugh at that. Now, because
you survived. Yeah,
I lived. I would get in cabs at 4 o'clock in the morning. I blacked out and I would start fights with the cab driver. Now, cab drivers in New York have seen everything. So at one point, I'd be outside of the cab yelling and screaming. He'd have a baseball bat. What I always say to myself is, thank God in a blackout, I didn't grab his baseball bat and knock the shit out of him. Now, all that behavior, people go, oh, my God, Largo was crazy. Yes, I was. But I can have a chuckle about that now because I don't drink or drug no matter what. No matter what. And, you know, then it was just crazy times. And yeah. I lived through it. And, you know, when people say you don't drink, like not even like a maybe like a little beer. No, I do not, because one thing leads to another. You know, a 94-year-old mom died 4 years ago. Thank God I had 10 years clean and sober. I went to Vermont to see my mom. Can you imagine if my mom died and I didn't go? What kind of shit is that? No, I had 10 years. She was really ill, 94 years old. And I could see it was at the end. And, you know, the beauty, and sometimes there is beauty in death, that when she was going,
take your time, bud.
Mm. Yeah, I can't imagine.
I was the last one to hug her. And when I was born, she was the first one to hug me. Mm. So it's like a full circle thing. And that's what you show up for.
Yeah.
So I know as a clean and sober man, I show up for everything. Yeah. You ask me to be somewhere, that's what I do. I am a responsible human being that shows up. If you ask me, I show up for your life. I show up for my life. And that's the beauty for me, of being clean and sober and helping other people, alcoholics, drug addicts, non-alcoholics, friends in need, people who are struggling. sometimes life ain't so easy, but it's great that we're here. And I have a lot of fun all the time now, again. I mean, I had fun back then, but it was really nuts. It was really nuts. And
were you known as a wild man in the music industry?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because you're obviously killing it and signing amazing acts and changing the face of music.
How I never got fired from working on the first Tracy Chapman record. How I didn't get fired from working on a Metallica record. I mean, I did show up for my job. I just didn't show up for my life.
Yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah.
Personal, professional. I still knew somewhere here that was the job I wanted since I was 14 and I wasn't about to F it up.
Yeah.
So, you know. But, you know, people do crazy things when they drink and drug. And I'll tell you one more story, and then we really have to change the subject. I was 32 back then, and I was very sick. And my dad wound up getting up. What is that called? Like a brain aneurysm. So I said, oh, Dad, I need to borrow your credit cards because I can't pay the rent. And he was like all like in the hospital. And he said, but I thought you had a job, Michael. I said, but Dad, I just do. So I borrowed his credit card. Because on corporate cards, you can't take out money. It's corporate card.
It's just expenses, yeah.
Correct. So I used his card for drugs and alcohol. 3 days later, he died. Wow. Can you imagine how I felt? My dad died and I robbed my dad at 32 years old. So I went to Hazleton in Minneapolis because Bob Krasnow, our chairman at Electra, said you could pack up your office at 5 o'clock or you can get help. I went to Hazleton. I was hateful. I went and I did the 30-day program, but I was still obstinate. When I got out, I said, I'm going to show you. I don't know what the fuck I was going to show anybody. I stayed what they call a dry drunk. I didn't drink for 8 years. And I still had to go out every night. I had to entertain lawyers, managers, artists, publishers, local artists. And I did it well, believe it or not. And when I was done with that part, I'd run out and get drink and drugs. So at one point in time, I was just like, I can't believe my dad died. So I cut up his credit cards. And I wrote a prayer in a letter to him. And I went to there was a temporary stone there. And I went to the cemetery and I brought flowers. And I just, all I could say, what they call in the program is you make amends to somebody. The best thing I could do is cut up the cards, write a beautiful letter, let him know how sorry I am and that I'm going to get clean and sober. And that was the best I could do. Well, fast forward, I had 10 years. When my mom got sick and I knew I was going to do everything in my power to be there for my mother. And I was, because she was a cutie. She was this tall and she was funny. She had an identical twin too. They were hysterical.
Both. She's in the documentary, right? Your mom?
No, I talk about her, but no, she's not in the documentary, unfortunately.
Is your sister in it?
My sister, yeah, Cheryl, is in my documentary. Yes, that's correct.
Anybody watching this who hasn't seen it, who the fuck is that guy is the name of the movie. And it's just amazing, Michael. Could you regale us with the story of Lynyrd Skynyrd? You get a phone call from Bill Graham and he says, can you come down to Jacksonville this weekend? This is an amazing story.
That's a goodie.
And thank you for sharing all that stuff with us, Michael.
It's all good. This is my life. And I want to let people know that even if you drink and you drug and you ask for help, and if you're serious about getting the help that you need, here we are. Here we are, 2021. Just to let you know, there is a movie out about me called Who the Fuck Is That Guy? The Fabulous Journey of Michael Alago. It was on Netflix and Amazon Prime for 3 years. My contract is up. It's nowhere to be seen right now. You could buy a DVD on Amazon.
Can you get it on Apple? Can you get it on iTunes? Can you rent it on there?
No, nowhere. 3 years is a long time for a documentary to be on Netflix. In any event, the good part about it is there's always a silver lining with me, you know, because I always make that stuff happen because I don't take no for an answer. Anyway, so Drew Stone, our fearless leader, our director, we are talking to another distributor. We just signed a little contract with them. And my hopes is that we get on Hulu this time. That's where I really want to be. And so I hope we get on one of those big platforms. I know we'll get on Apple Plus. I know we'll get on IMDb. So the movie will be out again in the first quarter of next year so that everybody who didn't see the movie, and I don't know why they didn't see the damn movie, can see it. And during Amazing. That time, yeah, during that time period also, I got a book deal and I put out a little book called I Am Michael Ilago, Breathing Music, Signing Metallica, Beating
Which
Death.
Is also great. And it goes into a lot good. More detail, it as books good. Obviously always do.
Yes, yes, yes. It starts in Brooklyn and it ends with my mom. And it's all good. And I didn't know I was going to feel so emotional today, but you know, I haven't talked about my mom and like, well, I do talk about my mom, but in depth, I haven't had to talk about her in a long time. So my mom is always right here. And I have faith that, you know, she lit candles. Oh, I'm not. She lit candles for me, really Catholic, to St. Jude my whole life. All when she died, I guess, when I was 58. So I like to think all those prayers my mom said for me helped keep me alive. And she was a cutie pie. So anyway, yeah, you can get my book. I Am Michael Ilago. It's available for like $20 on Amazon.com. So go get the book. And yeah, so sure, I could tell you a good story from the book. So
that's me pointing at the people to get the book, Michael.
Get the effing book. Come on. You spent $20 on a lot of garbage out there. Get a good book. Make it your stocking stuffer for Christmas.
If you're a fan of Metallica, it's a must-buy.
If you're a fan of sex, drugs, rock and roll,
yeah,
living a good life, and asking for help, and now living a clean and sober life, it's a fun read. It really is a fun read. And so anyway, there is a good chapter. I'm at Geffen Records in Los Angeles. And somebody said, David's calling. And I'm like, oh my God, what does David want? You know, the chairperson. He said, call Bill Graham. I said, for what? He said, I don't know. Call Bill Graham.
Could you just tell everybody as well, if they don't know who Bill Graham is? Because he's a
Bill
fucking
Graham,
legend.
Bill Graham, rest in peace, was a historic concert promoter. He ran the...
Day on the Green, right?
Well... He did many things. He managed many artists. Oh, God. He opened the Fillmore East in New York. Historic venue. He worked on many live concerts. He was legendary. So if you don't know Bill Graham, you can look up Bill Graham. So I call up Bill Graham as per Mr. Geffen. And I said, hi, Mr. Graham, this is Michael Ilago from Geffen. He goes, call me Bill. And I said, okay, but I don't think I can. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm at Geffen in LA. He goes, can you come to Jacksonville? I said, sure. He goes, can you come tomorrow? I said, no, I'm finishing a project, but I can come on Monday. I said, do you mind telling me what this is about? He said, no. I'd like you to come. So like Mr. Geffen, you don't argue with Bill Graham. That's major history, old school. So I said, okay. So I fly from New York to Jacksonville, and Bill Graham and his driver pick me up. They're in the front, I'm in the back, and he just turns around and he starts talking to me about Jimmy Page and Janis and the concerts at Laura Nero and the concerts at the Village. At the Fillmore East, and I'm just sitting there being regaled by Bill Graham, not even asking for it. You know, you can't buy that stuff. So we get to a mall, like a, you know, a mall, M-A-L-L, a mall. And I still don't know what the F is going on. And he said, well, we're here.
Isn't this mall all shut down as well? Like everything's boarded up and not a soul in sight. You're like, you describe it in the book as like Night of the Dawn of the Dead.
Oh my God. Whose story is this? Jesus. I love you, Matt, but who's telling the fucking story here? We get to the mall. The mall is empty, as per Matt. And, but thank you, Matt. I love you.
It's an interesting detail.
Like I wasn't going to tell you the detail? Don't give away the punchline. So we get to the mall. It's empty. It really feels like Night of the Living Dead. Lights are on, and they're down the whole middle of the entire mall. There were fake green plants, and there was like little fountains. And we thought, this is like an empty place, but there are water fountains. Very George Romero. So we're walking, and we're having, you know, small talk. All of a sudden, I hear music. And I'm like, holy shit. This could only be the Allman Brothers or Lynyrd Skynyrd. And either or, I would flip right out. And so we get to this another little corner, and they're playing. So we knock on the door, and the drummer from Lynyrd Skynyrd, what is his name? I'll remember in a minute, opens up the door.
The hell's his name?
Yes. we might have to look it up.
Artemis? Artemis?
Artemis Pyle!
There it is.
Opens up the door.
There it is.
And I said, hi. And then Gary Rossington says to me, can you give us a minute? Absolutely. So Artemis comes out and he shows me his, you want to see my scrapbook? Absolutely. Little did I know the scrapbook was going to be of the accident. And so the first picture is Artemis with his leg up in a hospital bed and pins, like hundreds, almost hundreds of pins coming out of his leg. And I was looking at this scrapbook that was very early Skynyrd, including the articles that every newspaper across America wrote about the accident. And I was learning I get back into it's a really little space. And Johnny, the singer, I was in awe. I was like, oh man, I love your band so much. He said, well, I'm the new guy in the band. And we shook hands and he gave me a CD and he said, we're going to play you some songs because we want to be on Geffen Records. So they play me all the new songs. The new songs were very good. And I was so happy to be there. And Gary, being the gentleman that he is, he said, you know, thank you for coming to hear our music. And we're going to have dinner tonight. Probably 18 of us. We're going to have dinner tonight. Great. So he says, well, would you like to hear anything else? And like, I turn into this 14-year-old kid from Brooklyn. And I'm like, yes, I want to hear something else. So of course, Gary thinks I'm going to say Freebird. And he's like, one, two, three. And they start Freebird. And I said, oh, wait a minute. Do you think anybody ever stopped Skynyrd from playing Freebird?
Gonna have to stop you a minute there, guys. That wasn't the one I wanted. They're like jamming the best song ever. And you're like, it's not my favorite though.
Right. So, you know, when you hear the beginning of any Skynyrd song and you hear that Hammond B3, you know what you're listening to. So I said, could you play That Smell? And they, yes. Again, boom. One, two, three. And I was sitting on the floor now with my legs crossed, like I was 14 in Brooklyn and listening to That Smell. Now, it don't get no better than that when you have a rock and roll story to tell. Now,
That Smell. It's so good.
So that night we all go to dinner and I didn't wind up signing them. You know, we were signing new things at Geffen, whether it's a White Zombie, a Sonic Youth, Beck, Guns N' Roses, Cher, Whitesnake, and they just didn't fit in. I was glad they found a home at Atlantic Records, and that's my Skynyrd Bill Graham story.
That's great.
It's so a good one.
It is. I feel like it's just, there's such a magical time in music, you know, and I grew up around it. I was too young to be in it, but, you know, through the 80s and early 90s, man, to me, that's just such a magical time in music. I love that shit.
What was your first concert?
So I was a little pastor's kid, a very sheltered pastor's kid. I could only go to Christian concerts. So my first concert was a band called Petra, which is like, you know, a Christian rock band.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But my first real like concert that made me go, oh, I love music, was a band from Providence called Kilgore Smudge. They went on to be Kilgore. And that kind of opened the doors to heavy rock and hardcore and punk. And that's kind of where I got my gateway, was that band Kilgore.
How old were you?
14 years old.
Uh-huh. And as a young person, hearing that, witnessing that, when did you start listening to so much music? This is an unfair question, that you started to have favorite bands. It's like saying, like, you know, who's your favorite kid? But at a young age, what else did you hear?
Yeah, yeah. 14 was the age. That was when I just couldn't get enough. You know, and that was the age of mixtapes. You know, I had cassette tapes from friends with different bands on it. And I heard Minor Threat, and Minor Threat was the first band that kicked me in the face. And I thought to myself, I knew Metallica, I knew Anthrax. My brother was really into those bands. I got into them too, and I enjoyed them. But the first band that made me want to do it, and like I became obsessed with, was Minor Threat. And that just threw me into all kinds of hardcore and punk rock, from, you know, the Misfits to Negative Approach to, you know, Operation.
Cro-Mags.
Oh, Cro-Mags, of course, Cro-Mags. Yeah.
My favorite.
Agnostic Front, Sick of It All. It just, I head first into that shit at
Big
14.
Time. Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, cool. I couldn't get enough. I was obsessed. And I was the young kid. I was like the Harley Flanagan of Providence. I was the little kid that would get into the shows. I was in my first band at 15, playing clubs like Club Babyhead, The Living Room, Lupo's. I lived at those places from the age of 14 to like 19, nonstop.
And so when you say 19, did something happen at 19?
That Providence shifted. Babyhead closed down, and that was kind of the end of an era. You know, there was clubs that came after it. Lupo's moved around. But to me, that was when Babyhead closed its doors, that was our CBGBs. That was the end of it for me. Like, I started traveling and touring with my bands, and Providence wasn't the same. But that was the glory days for me. I'll never forget it.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Great. That's wonderful. Matt, I don't know where we're going.
This is great. Occasionally, I like to just sit back and, you know, let the guest and Jesse just jam
since
out.
When?
And since just like 5 minutes ago, it's a recent thing. I want to ask you about this. Is there anybody in New York that's friends with both John and Harley? Because it seems like there's two camps, and I get that it's kind of like, you know, the divorce, and you got to almost choose your parent. Are you friends of Harley? Do you know Harley? Because I know you and John are very close.
Yeah.
There you go, right there.
Smart man. Smart man.
That's the way it goes, is it?
Next
question.
No. One quickie. In Harley's defense, back in the day, I wanted to sign the Cro-Mags to Elektra. It's around 1983. I just start there. I love Harley. He is also a wildly charismatic, crazy motherfucker. And he would come to my office all the time. I fed him all the time. I helped him pay the rent when he needed rent money. At one point in time, there was a kid that he thought he was his. We were friends. I really don't, you know, and I'm not here ever to give anybody a bad, you know, not name, because they could do that on their own. Anyway, something happened where we just weren't friends anymore. And one of the reasons I didn't sign Cro-Mags to Elektra, even though Cro-Mags were one of my top five all-time favorite bands, is it would have been very unfair, you know, to sign a band like that to a corporation. The corporation would not have understood them. I would have been the only one going out at night. So it's best that 38 years later, I still talk about the Cro-Mags. I still love the Cro-Mags. And yes, there was a divorce with Harley and John, and I just wound up on the John camp. I adore John. I know him forever. He is a solid human being. He's an awesome writer. He is a dear friend. During the pandemic, he would bring vegan food to my lobby for me almost every day.
I'd live for those photos on Facebook. You'd be like the delivery guys being again.
We made little 1 minute clips, and he would come to Mass. We were both Mass. He'd come to my lobby and he would call me every name in the book, and I filmed it. So we have very people like holding their stomach with laughter.
Yeah, it was amazing.
He's a solid human being. He has two books out right now. One, I believe, is called Unfuck Your Health. And the other one, it has to do with recipes. Yep. He's a great, great vegan chef. So anyway, that's that about them.
Yeah, I had them both on my show, and I found them both to be amazing characters. Yeah, proper New Yorkers, you know, like yourself.
Absolutely.
You know, we've been blessed with a few of them on the show.
Sorry, Matt. And Age of Quarrel is one of the greatest records ever. But I also love the second album, Best Wishes.
Yeah,
it's more rock, but I love both those records so much. So much.
Yeah, it's a band that I definitely wouldn't be who I am without. I mean, I would say them, Agnostic Front and Bad Brains were the three that just shaped me and propelled me. Yeah. Very important stuff.
Agnostic Front. Roger. Are you listening to us? We love you.
Yeah.
I hope you're healing up, because you're part of this great, big, crazy world we all live in. We want to hear more music from you. We love you, and we love your family, and we love your crazy band, and loved your documentary. Thank you, Ian McFarland.
Yes.
And, good. Oh, boy. Now, that's a film as well. Again,
heartbreaking, that one. Made me cry.
I just got goosebumps too.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So anyway, we love you, Roger. And I think from last things that I heard, he's getting better. Thank God.
Yeah.
I
spoke with him a few days ago via Instagram.
You did?
Yeah. He's doing good. Yeah.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Oh, good news. Good news.
Yeah. That's a guy that I have so much love for, that guy.
And
the few times that I've been able to hang out with him and be around him, he's one of those people. I mean, you could say the same thing about most of these guys. They're just real motherfuckers. They're not.
He is very humble.
Yeah, he's so sweet and like still a badass. Like I just have so much respect for him, just as a human being and a musician. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Hey, Michael, would you mind telling about making Mina's first solo record with her, because she's one of our favorite people. We had her on the show. We love her. She was an amazing guest. She just came on, took over. And that record is so good. And it just kind of got overlooked, I guess, right? I wonder if you could tell us about the making of that album and just
you know
her as an artist, because she's amazing.
I'm going to get up for a minute, but I'm sure you can amuse yourself for 30 seconds.
We got this.
Shut up, 30 seconds.
You take care of business, Michael. You take care of business.
It's not like I have to piss or anything.
sure.
Hold on.
He's going to grab the record. Dude, this is amazing, right?
Yeah, this actually reminds me of when we had Stigma on and he left.
Yeah. It was that same energy, isn't it?
You could hear him yelling at somebody in the background.
It's so good, man. Just, I can't believe I still have never been to New York. And when I eventually do get to go, I'm going to do the rounds. Are you going to be in New York on the week of the 22nd of March? Or are you going to be still out on tour then?
Why? What's happening on the 22nd of March?
Well, my second book's coming out on the 8th, Michael, and
okay.
I'm hoping to do a launch party in New York with Jesse Malin, kind of putting like a little super group together of a bunch of guests that are going to be in it. And I want to try and do a launch party the week of the 22nd, because I'm then going down to Miami to go on a cruise, the Flogging Molly cruise, which I just announced today, actually. So I'm hoping to do New York for a week, book launch party, down to Miami, cruise, then home. So I'll be looking you up, Michael. And if you're around, I'd love to go out for dinner with you and
see
your town.
I most certainly will be around for you, of course. But I'm going to be shameless for 2 seconds because, you know, I love John Joseph. This is his book, Hardcore Kitchen. Tons of fabulous recipes. And then his second book is Unfuck Your Health. And he really does give solid advice.
Check it out. I got one here as well. I got the first one.
The Evolution of a Cro-Mag.
He's getting that triple plug in.
Oh, my God, John, you better be grateful, bitch. And you better get me some more food because I'm hungry. I love you. Hungry. Okay. Yeah. Also, we were talking
about... Check this one out as well, Michael. Have you got this one, Sean's book?
No, I live under a rock. Yes, hon. Yes, I do. All that ribbing, hon, is just teasing.
You know? I love it.
It's good teasing. I have.
This is an amazing book.
We love Shauna. She is one of my dearest, 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 dearest friends. Her and Phil Anselmo, both of them. I don't know how that got into talking about him. But yeah, I love them both. They both live in New Orleans, you know?
It's because they were at the party that you rolled up at in the story.
But Phil, I love Phil with all my heart and soul.
We spoke about getting Phil on this show. We'd like to do it. I don't know whether you'd be able to facilitate that, would you, Michael?
I will tell his wife, Kate, that you need to do it.
We'd love to have him on and chat to him and hear his story. It'd be amazing.
So when we write to each other, we're Ma and Pa. Because I'm Ma, M-A, he's Pa, P-A. It's a laugh. Nobody else gets it. It's corny. I don't give a shit. So we were talking about early days when Jesse was like all of 19 and he was going to shows and he brought up, bands like Minor Threat and that his older brother, I think you said, was listening to more like Metallica like that. So I just found these fabulous little cassettes.
Wow, look at that.
This cassette is that famous underground
that's awesome.
Cassette that was going around and around. Now, this is probably like a fourth generation, but it appeared on my desk one day early on. It blew my mind. What? No Life Till Leather. And I think it's spelled wrong, which is the beauty of it all. Yeah. Then many moons later, Lars decided, we're going to put that out again. So they take the cassette and on record day, you know, we have that record day here in the States. I don't know, a couple years ago, they decide they're going to put out that demo again.
I love it.
It still smells. It still sounds like shit, but it's historic. It's Metallica. And you know, they're a band that, you know, that sometimes gets, they're like, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. It's like a lot of people are like, oh man, they should have made, you know, like those first three records again. Sure, they could have made Kill 'Em All, Ride the Lightning and A Master of Puppets again. Doesn't do the artist any good. You don't develop. And, you know, having this 40-year career is because they took chances. They weren't afraid. They did what they wanted to do. And thank heavens, everybody has gone along for the ride.
Mm. Yeah. Were you and Metallica drinking at the same time? Did you have some nights out with them?
Honey.
The Alcoholica days. Yeah.
That's why they were called Alcoholica. And me too. Half of those nights I don't remember. I'll tell you a funny story. They play the Lyceum in London. We're all like, woo, screaming and carrying on backstage. I want to know if everybody wants to go to dinner. Half of them don't want to go to dinner. Oh, and by the way, rest in peace, Malcolm Dome, Kerrang! Magazine.
Yep.
I think I met him one of the first days I got to Electra in 83. God bless you.
He's the guy who coined the term thrash metal for the first time,
there
right?
There you go.
Yep.
Yes, sir. Malcolm Dome. Okay, we got to give props to all our friends because they can't give props to themselves, and we got to acknowledge the history. So Lars and Cliff, who I adored, we want to go to dinner with you. We go to a very posh restaurant on Neal Street in Soho in London, and we're sitting there. Of course, we were all drinking back then, and you know I love champagne, and Lars loved all his wines, and all of a sudden I look over. And I said, Cliff, we can't snort cocaine in here, please. He said, Alago, quiet down. It's purple snuff. I got it at the head shop. And I was like, oh, my God. We just laughed about it. we continued drinking, but it was always something with Cliff. He was a marvelous young man. I only had small encounters with him because I signed them in 84 and he was killed in September of 86, but he was a hoot. He was a stellar, as we all know, stellar musician. I liken him to one of my favorite musicians, Jaco Pastorius. Mm. I mean, one of a kind. Cliff was extraordinary. I used to say, when are you going to get some new jeans? He would say, fuck off and get me a six pack. Because, you know, he had those, what we called back then, elephant bell bottoms. And, you know, covered the whole foot. So I would just jab him about that all the time. I loved Cliff so much. Everybody who encountered Cliff Burton loved him. Mm. What was not to love, you know?
Jason's a good friend of yours too, right?
Jason is extraordinary. You know, it's because of, when Cliff passed and the band didn't know what they wanted to do. I don't know, maybe a month or two went by and Lars called me at Elektra in New York. And he says, I know we want to move forward. And Cliff wants us to move forward. We feel that in our hearts. What are we going to do? I said, well, I just signed a band called Flotsam and Jetsam. And I don't want to tell you about them. But I got to tell you, there's a young man named Jason Newsted, who is as charismatic as all of you, who is that dynamite spirit. He should be in the band. At that same time, Brian Slagle said the same thing. He didn't sign Flotsam. Well, he did an early Flotsam record. What was it? Doomsday for the Deceiver. And so it came from both parties. And so at some point, Jason went for the audition. We know he killed it, and he was in Metallica for about a good maybe 15 or 16 years, and that's not without a lot of ribbing and a lot of taking like advantage of him and not being kind to him in the early days. And you know, I always say that, you know, as young people, they never experienced a loss like Cliff in their life. It was their brother, it was their bandmate. And so when Jason got in, it was basically somewhere in here, you're not Cliff. That's a heavy burden for all four young people to like live with. But anyway, that all passed by. And, you know, like Jason was in the group for a good 15, 16 years. He was an awesome addition. Also a person who on stage, for me, could do no wrong. And, you know, I use that word charisma a lot because you either got it or you don't. Jesse has that.
No, thank you.
He is, you know, whether I'm listening to I just lost my brain, so forgive me. Whether I'm listening to, what am I listening to? I have no friggin' idea.
Time to Grace.
Oh my God. Whether it's the 2011 record, or I just bought the record yesterday on Amazon. Or listening to that, or if I'm listening to Killswitch, this is a person who also is that wildly charismatic person. And you can't buy stuff like that. You either got it or you don't got it. And my man, he has got it in spades. And that's an incredible thing. You cannot buy that. James Hetfield has that in spades. You cannot buy what he delivers on the stage. You too. You can't purchase that shit. It either is inherent in your heart and soul or it ain't. And now I forgot where I'm going with this.
Well, I think I could speak to that. I think it's just being real, right?
Yes.
I think that's what it is. You can either try to manufacture it or you just have it. And to me, I'm just being honest. And I think that's what it is.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.